You're listening to audio from The Village Church. If you'd like to check out more resources or give to our ministry, please visit us at thevillagechurch.net.
Good morning, church. My name is Trish Daniel. I serve with the events department as an usher for Connections and on the A-team for our Goer to Florence, Holly Taylor. This weekend's her birthday, so if you know her, send her some love. If you're wondering what is an A-team or if you're curious what it looks like to advocate for our goers, please reach out to the missions department. This morning, we're going to be reading from Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down from the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, if you have your Bible, Song of Solomon chapter 4 is where we'll be, but I'm going to build towards it. So this is week 4 of our series on marriage, and my topic, don't be nervous, is marital sex. And so not sex in the broad sense, but sex within the confines of marriage, which I would argue is God's design, and that all the data says the best sex happens within the confines of safe covenant marriage. And so let me go back here. JT did such a good job of setting me up for this weekend, last weekend. But if you've been to a Christian marriage, one of the components that can be present is the unity candle. And so what happens is usually the husband's family first comes out and they light this candle, and it's their baby boy. It's like he's grown up in their home, and there he is. That candle represents his personhood. And caught up in this candle is a sexual ethic. There's a way that sex was thought about and talked about in his home, and he is bringing that to bear here. It was either puritanical, where it was dirty and something to be avoided. It was indifferent, or there was some perversion there, and all of that is there. And then mom and dad of the bride come up, and they light. I mean, we've got to, it's just been that kind of morning, guys. It's going to be fun. This, that, and then they light it. And this is their baby girl, and it's, it has the same things in it. It has a sexual ethic with it. It was seen as dirty, something to not be talked about, something that was gross, or there was an indifference there, or there was some perversion there. And she's bringing that to bear. And then at some point in the middle of the service, the minister licensed friend will say our verse from week 1 and some of week 2, that the two shall become one flesh. And then somebody sings, and they come over and they take these two candles and they light this new one. And then I'm going to keep saying this. And then sometimes they blow out these candles, which you should just know. Don't do that, because you don't lose your personhood when you get married. Like, Jesus didn't lose himself. He gave himself. Remember, this is a picture of God's covenant love of his people. And then they light this candle. They're saying, we're bringing these two things to bear on this new thing that we're coveting to each other and to God and our friends to give ourselves over to. And that includes both of these sexual ethics. Now, if there was any kind of trauma in either one of these, That makes this exceedingly difficult. Exceedingly difficult. Because then on top of even what I've mentioned here, you've got hormone issues and chromosomal issues. You got that pesky hypothalamus, which is the part of the brain that drives sexual desire. And all of that comes to bear in this. And you've got all of that taking place in a hyper-sexualized culture where sex sells everything. And it's being exalted as the thing that we must do to find fulfillment and meaning in life, which is an incredibly powerful force in our culture. And it puts all kinds of pressure on us and robs us of the good gift that it actually is. A good gift placed wrongly is a nightmare, not a dream. Okay, now, here's my starting point. My starting point is God and the Bible are very pro-sex. They are very pro-sex. Like, I'll start with this. God made it. Like, there's no point of the creation narrative where the enemy gets involved and starts adding body parts that are going to be a stumbling block. All of it. Like, when he makes us and we are made, sex is given both for procreation and pleasure. There are parts of our biology that only exist for pleasure. Not procreation, pleasure. And that's God's gift. To point us towards the picture, don't lose that, to point us towards the picture. And I know you're looking at me and you're like, we shouldn't be talking about this here. And I'm saying we should talk about this more here. Let me show you how pro-sex God is. Deuteronomy 24, 5. When a man is newly married, he shall not go out with the army or be liable for any other public duty. He shall be free at home 1 year to be happy with his wife whom he has taken. I'd like to bring that back. Full year to do what? Try to make Lauren happy. Figure this thing out. Like, and keep in mind, this is like BC. This is a whole different world back here. This is one of the things that marked the people of God as distinct. In fact, I'm going to argue throughout the sermon, one of the things that makes us most distinct throughout all generations is our sexual ethic. That we are not anti-sex, we celebrate sex, we marvel at the good gift of sex, but we keep it within the parameters that our good heavenly Father has created for our own safety. You'll see that more and more. Love this one. Proverbs 5, 18 through 19. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight and be intoxicated always in her love. That doesn't sound like God's very prudish, does it? Like, marvel at your wife's chest like you've had a couple of glasses of wine. Like, every time you see them, let your face be warm. I'm reading the Bible. Look it up in your own. That's in the book. Wisdom literature. Those things are awesome. Now, let's keep going. 1 Corinthians 6, 15 through 20. By the way, in the 9, I had like 5 dudes yell out amen at that spot. And then I got to course correct them a little bit later in our primary passage, but let's go 1 Corinthians 6, 15 through 20. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Let me stop because there's something cultural happening in this text that still exists in a lot of places in the world. In the time that 1 Corinthians was written, in Rome, Rome's culture, which is what made Christians so odd, Rome's culture was you married for social positioning, not for fulfillment. And so the cultural norm was that a man would get his sexual needs met through prostitutes. And I'm telling you, this still exists in China and it still exists in India, where the Judeo-Christian ethic hasn't laid across to culture. This is still, in parts of the world today, normal. That I don't come to my wife to get those needs met, that's not what she's for. She's there to give me children and to run my household. I get those needs met down in the red light district. And that still exists today in nations where the Judeo-Christian ethic wasn't the dominant ethic across. I'm telling you, I worked in those red light districts last year when I was overseas. This is still normal. Like, the wives know it. The culture knows it. It's like standard operating procedure. You've got some compulsion. It's not your wife. It's them. And what's Paul saying here? Don't do that. But listen to the why behind it. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For it is written, we're going back to Genesis, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body. But the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price. So glorify God in your body. Here's a general rule I want you to have as you read the Bible. Behind every prohibition, there is something beautiful. He does not denigrate the sexual act here. He elevates the body. Do you see his argument? Your body is not your own. Your body should not be joined. And here's the dominant philosophy under the modern kind of imagination around sex. It is the demonic ideology behind every grotesque perversion around sex, gender, and life issues, and it is that we are different than our bodies, that our bodies are not us, we are us, and our bodies like this machine that we can do whatever we want with. Now, Paul here is making this argument. No, God is making this argument. No, you're more valuable than that, and you are not different than your body. You are your body, and if you treat your body poorly, you will do damage to your soul. Do you see the elevation of the body in this text? He's like, you are your body. You can't harm your body without harming your soul. You can't do it. And so this idea that I am not my body and my body is this other thing, I can do whatever I want with this body, and that's true freedom, is actually enslavement. And the Apostle Paul here and the God of the created universe is saying, no. You're more valuable than that. Please don't do that to yourself. Sex is a beautiful thing, but it's going to have profound consequences if you treat your body cheaply. Don't do it. And then let me go to this last one before we get into our primary text. 1 Corinthians 7:5-9. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer and then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all, whereas I myself am, he's going to define that here in a second, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. So what did he mean earlier when he said that I wish you were all like me? What does he mean? I wish you were single. A single person is not divided heart, mind, and time. A single person has a gift that the married person doesn't have, and the married person has a gift that the single person doesn't have, but both have been gifted for the days that God has given them. Right? That's the text. Now, let me keep reading. But if you cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Here was a fun little word study this week, especially in this passage, because I've already heard that text in particular in a negative sense. Like, if you're a horn dog, you better hurry up and get married. You know, it's just like this. I bet you never heard that word from the pulpit before. I don't know that I've ever said it. We'll see how it goes for me this week and whether I'm back next weekend. But here's actually the Greek word here actually is, it's different than this. It means frustrated in love. And here, it's something cultural is in view, and here's what's culturally in view. Remember what marriage was? Marriage wasn't because I love you or because marriage was like, how do I increase my social status? How do I marry someone who can make my future, my kids, my family? How can I position us correctly? And here we go with the Judeo-Christian ethic beginning to push into the Roman Empire, where Paul says, no, no, no. Like, if you're frustrated in love with someone, like if you're like, God, I love them, I just want to marry, but it doesn't make financial sense. It doesn't make sense for where I think I want my family to be in the next generation. Marry them. Marry them. And so he's flipping this whole thing on its head. He's taking the proverbial genie and he's putting it in the bottle of covenant relationship and covenant love. If this is true and God is pro-sex, and we'll read a whole chapter here in a second that Hebrew boys weren't allowed to read until they were a certain age, right? Why then can sex be so contentious even inside marriage? All the data says it's money and sex that blows up marriages. Money and sex blow up marriages. So why is it so contentious if it's this good gift and God has given it to us, not just for pleasure, but for connection? I'm glad you asked, because that's my whole sermon. Let me explain it maybe like this. In 2017, my friend Lance was out at his, it was like a high fence ranch not far from here, kind of middle of nowhere. And he was with my brother-in-law, whose name's Jonathan. And it was a it was like high fence, you know, that means basically there are animals on there that aren't indigenous to Texas that you should shoot. I think that's lazy and cheating, like get to Colorado or something, right? But that's what it was, and they went out there just to chill. They weren't hunting, and the design was there was a like an old house on there that kind of made a hunting cabin, and then there was this carport, and then there was a fireplace. And I think the design was, even if it's raining or snowing or whatever, you could be under the carport and enjoy all the benefits while remaining safe of a fire in a fireplace, except there were structural design issues in the building of that fireplace, and the chimney caught on fire. And so the whole fireplace is now on fire, and then it starts to burn across the carport, and this is not call 911 and get the fire. This is volunteer fire department. You got to call Billy Bob and get him up and get him into the truck and get him out here. And so they've got to get service, make the call, come back, use the water hose to try to save the house. And the illustration I'm trying to draw is, though, even though the fire was in the right place, if the structure is bad, then it can still burn it all to the ground. And so here's my intent. My intent is to show you the God-given structure in which the fire has the best shot at providing comfort, providing peace, and being what it was meant to be. We good? That's the plan. And so last week, JT did a great job of showing us that there are multiple Greek words for love. In fact, I thought kind of exclamation point was at this moment, we're not exchanging phileo, friendship, for eros, passion. That's not what happens on the wedding day. Our friendship's over. It's go time. That's not. Now, probably somebody's bringing that there, but that's not actually what's meant to happen. And so I want to do something similar, but I'm going to use the Hebrew words. One, because I studied this years and years ago and wrote a little book called Mingling of Souls, and I just thought the platform. I can't think about this or talk about this and not have my head and heart go back to the platform that God built and designed. And so here's the structure, if you will, that God's given us that we need to pay attention to, because if the structure's wrong or broken, then that fire, we're in a lot of danger with it, okay? So let's dive in. The first Hebrew word, if you start reading through Song of Solomon, what you see is a relationship develop in the way that God designed it, and gets to this idea, this concept of dod, which is a mingling of souls. That's what it means. And so the first kind of building block of the structure of marital sex is the idea of raya. Let me give you, this is Song of Solomon 5:16. This is my raya, and this is my friend. This is my beloved. This is my friend. This is Raya, and this is how you started. If you're married, this is how you started. It starts with a friendship, right? And we are social relational beings because we're made in the image of God, and God is triune. He is three in one. He exists in perfect relationship within himself. And therefore, to be made in his image is to be called into relationship with others. And so Raya becomes the bedrock, right? It was phileo from last week. This idea of friendship, that I'm learning who you are. I ask you out, or we meet on an app, or we get together somehow, and we're starting to kind of have conversations about one another, where we're from, what we like, what we don't like. And this is Raya. It's cultivated. It's built into. And then there is some point in that journey of Raya that you see some things that are disorienting. It's why you're probably not married to the first person you ever went out with. You're on like date four and you're like, yep, nope. You were 6 months in and you're like, not a chance. You were 2 years down and you're like, you know what? This is not compatible. We are not doing this. And then you break up. And then you might stay friends, you might not, but then Raya begins with something. Like you went through Raya to get to the next block, Ahava. And Ahava is like a love of the will. Here's the way I've always described it. I've seen you're crazy, and I'm still in. So if you're married, then what happened is, as you were kind of working through Raya, you saw some things. You started to have a consistent fight. You realized you were seeing the world in different ways. You have different ideas about how this should work or this should work. It could be how kids are raised or how many. It could be how money's spent or how. It could be 1,000 different things. And in the middle of that confrontation, you with your will said, I'm staying. Let me show you this in the text. This is Song of Solomon 8:6-7. I want you to hear the aggression in the descriptor. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for ahava is strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. It's flashes or flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Listen to this. Many waters cannot quench ahava. Not raya, ahava. Many waters, a tidal wave couldn't rip me from you. Do you hear it? This isn't like, oh, you make me happy. This is, man, a storm, a tsunami, and I'm not going anywhere. Neither can floods drown it. If a man offered for ahava all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. Do you see the value placed on this kind of love? If you offered all the wealth of your house for it, you'd be utterly despised. This is him going, you'd be an idiot. You'd be a fool. Like ahava, like raya and ahava going together began to create an environment where men and women can feel safe, where they feel they're seen and known and they can move towards it. And this is important because to get to Dode, those things have to be in place. I'm not saying to have sex. Sex is easy. It's just easy. And if you try to get these things out of order, I'm not saying you can't have an orgasm. I'm saying you ain't got a shot at Dode. You ain't got a shot of deep soul level intimacy. And here's why. If you introduce physicality too early, and again, this is not God being a prude. God is all about this. Like, this is God saying, you're more valuable than this. You are not your body. You are not just a body. Your body isn't just a mechanism for you to play with. You are your body. So what ends up happening if you introduce physicality too soon is you never actually get to know the person, because that's much harder than fooling around. You know how much easier it is to fool around than to dig and try to get to know the person who's across from you? And yet, this actually is the foundation of intimate relationship. Sex is not intimate if it's just mechanical, which is why so much perversion exists. Because people will continue to chase that kind of transcendent feeling that can occur physically, but it gives way, and so you have to increase in perversity, increase in wickedness. And if you've ever wondered how people can like do things that for the normal person sounds just, I can't get my head around that, this is what happens. There's no friendship connection. There's no safety of commitment. And so they treat their body like a machine, not knowing the damage it does for them. And to get the high, it has to increase in perversity. Like there is a massive swinging population in our area. How do you get there? How do you get to the place where you're like, I'd like another man to make love to my wife? How do you get to that kind of darkness? Well, you have to detach your personhood from your body. And you have to not genuinely care about that person. Their body has to be seen by you as a mechanism for pleasure, discounted and dismantled from their personhood. It's demonic, it's evil, and this is how it happens. There's no kind of I see you relational, you're my person. So to get to dode, these two things not only have to be in place, but they have to be solid. They don't have to be in place, they have to be solid. And then dode, that word means to carouse, to fondle, to rock, to mingle. The mingling of souls. This is what the soul is hungry for, and this is what the gift of sex can offer within the boundaries that God has placed. So let me show you it in action. In Song of Solomon 1:6, we meet his bride, and here's what she says. Do not gaze at me because I am dark. The actual word there is swarthy. Because the sun has looked upon me. My mother's sons were angry with me, and they made me keepers of the vineyard. But my own vineyard I have not kept. So let's talk about the text. One, there's always something about this that stands out to me because this is my experience. Like my wife is a beautiful woman, and it's not uncommon for her to look in the mirror and be like, I'm so gross. And I'm like, you are not gross. And women are like so hard on men. Dudes are just like, not a clue. You know, it's like gut and hair everywhere. Like, you're welcome, babe. And it's like, you have no idea how gross you are. Right? It's just such a weird thing that women are like, this cheek is like a quarter of an inch off. I'm deformed. And men don't, I mean, they don't have that thought at all. It's like, you're welcome, baby. It's like, well, you might want to shave some of that up in there. You got like buckwheat coming out the side of your, right? This is just, and she's there, but I want to highlight this. What's she pointing to? Well, she's pointing to family trauma. Did you hear it? Like, it's funny how cultural standards of beauty change. In this moment of history, pasty white skin is a sign. And tan skin was seen as a whole other class of people. They were workers in the sun and royalty. This is the king of Israel involved in this little thing here. And now she's like, don't look at me. I am, my mother's sons, her brothers, were angry with me. And they forced me to work in the vineyard. And here's her claim. I've been so busy taking care of everyone else. I have not taken care of myself. Don't look at me. Don't look at me. And now watch him. So they get married. They have the wedding. It's a beautiful text there in Song of Solomon 3. And now we're wedding night, honeymoon. There's a lot going on here. I'm not going to unpack completely because there's kids in the room. But I might. I mean, you know me. I'm wheels off today. Here we go. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. So that, I forgot. Pause. This isn't going to translate, brothers. If you're trying to snatch some game from Solomon, it's probably not. Like later on, I think in the next chapter, he says that her belly is like a heap of wheat. And that is not a line you want to try to incorporate into your game. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down from the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost his young. Now here's, this is just, I don't know if you'll ever go read Song of Solomon. Solomon loves him some teeth. He does this like four times in the book, and every time, like when they're 60, he does this again, and he's like, and baby, you still got them teeth. He's got a smile thing. I respect that. He's got a smile thing. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Do you see what he's doing? He's starting at the top. He's starting at the top of her head, and he's just slowly, what's he doing? He's wooing her out of her insecurities. He's calling her out of her trauma. He hasn't pounced on her. He hadn't tore all his clothes off like he's been looking forward to this since he was 12, but you know he had. That's real, isn't it? Like, men and women tend to burn at different temperatures. Not all of us, but most of us. Like, in general, men burn a little hotter. It can often be said they're microwaves. Women are crockpots. But look at him here. He's not in a hurry. He's just like, dang, baby, your hair, your eyes, that nose, your neck. And then we get back to those deer. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies. This is for free. How do you approach baby deer in a field grazing on lilies? Let me just say that. You don't run at them. You don't run at them, right? You don't aggressively run them down and tackle them. It's a bad move. Until the day breathes and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. You are all together beautiful, my love, there is no flaw in you. Do you see what he's doing? I don't know if you see that. Like he's saying, I want you. I don't want your body. I want you. There is no flaw in you. I am not after a physical act. I want the intimacy of being with you. You're what I want, not the act, you. And if you give me the act and not you, it won't be what I'm after. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. That's a different kind of kissing. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Listen, a garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. Do you see how he's not pouncing? He's trying to call her out of her hurt and her insecurity. He's even now like, how much time is this taking? This is a wedding night. Tell them I'm busy. 12. 13. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all choicest fruits, henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices. Verse 15, a garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. And finally, she responds, awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind. Blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. By the way, one of those winds blows hard and one of those winds blows soft. Just leave that there. Let its spices flow. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. Did you see how, like, he sees her. He moves towards her. He understands at some level the complexity of what she's experienced, and he's not calling on duty. He's not quoting 1 Corinthians, not to withhold. He's wooing her out of the brokenness, and he's doing it with an unbelievable amount of patience. Like, gosh, he's got this whole poem, and then 3/4 of the way through, he's like, the garden is locked. It's still locked. She has not welcomed me in, and he will not move until she does so. Until she says, a garden unlocked is your beloved. Oh, come, north wind. Oh, come, south wind. Partake. And here, after this, chapter 5 starts with, eat and drink your fill, you lovers, because God's not a prude. And so here's, this is a picture of when the structure's right, and when we've given ourselves over to the Lord, and when we've cultivated the raya, and we've established the ahava, we got a shot at. Now, I'm not saying every time's like this. Sometimes it's like in the afternoon, you got 5 minutes before the kids get home. But this is the foundation. This is the opportunity. This is what is possible. Now, it's not possible. And again, keep in mind what I'm doing here. I'm talking about the structure and design of marital sex. I am not talking about orgasms, because I think you can have one of those and it not be fulfilling at all. I'm not talking about, like, I'm saying this is the structure that God's given us to look at and consider when we think about marital sex. If at some point in your past, life got busy and you pressed pause on Raya, that's going to affect this. Like, here's one of my favorite things about Lauren. She has been like 13 different women since I married her. And here's what, I think that's awesome, because I can get to know this new woman. Like, there was Lauren before kids, Lauren pregnant. She was scary. I think she was scared of her when she was pregnant. And then there was Lauren as a mother. Oh my gosh, Lauren as a mother. And then, you know, then there was Lauren growing into her gifts, Lauren learning her authority, Lauren sustaining our family when I was going through brain cancer. There was Lauren enduring storms. There were Lauren coming up, Lauren winning and losing and being grown by the Lord into the full person that she is today. And I get to know each and every one of those. And sometimes I get to know one of those because I get in trouble in a new way. I didn't know that was a new rule. And now all of a sudden I've got this, okay, what's going on? Why? Because I've been doing it like that for 20 years. Have you just been tolerating that for 20 years? Or is there a value shift that I need to know? And what we don't want to do is press pause on that. And some of you, what you want is you want good friend sex when you press pause on good friend 10 years ago. That's what's happening to some of you. Like, you have not cultivated an intimate friendship and you want intimate sex. So your partner is going to feel the disconnect. They're going to feel it. So how hard is it to give yourself over to someone, especially if you're a woman? Give yourself over to someone who you think doesn't value what you think, value what you see and think and hear, and doesn't value. Like, it's almost impossible. So then brothers will start playing the duty card. How sexy is that? I ain't trying to hate on you, brother. It's kind of pathetic. You don't need sex to have a fulfilling life. That's a lie. If you needed sex to experience the fullness of life, then you're saying Jesus didn't have it. You're saying the Apostle Paul didn't have, you're saying millions of our brothers and sisters across time and space never had the fullness of life because they weren't having mind-blowing sex. You're echoing demonic ideologies of our day. It's just not true. It's just not true. Now, it is a gift. It's not a bad thing to desire. I mean, all over the scriptures we're told this is a good thing, right? And so some of you, though, you're wanting kind of deep, intimate, mind-blowing sex while pressing pause on Raya. And then some of you, it's not Raya, it's an Ahava issue. Can we just have, you got any fantasies in your head about what it would be like with a husband that was more like this or less like that or better than this or less than that? Brothers, you got fantasies in your head of what it would be like to be with this woman or that woman, this? Every time you look at porn, softcore or hardcore, you're violating Ahava. I know five guys in the last month that I know personally that have told me with their mouths have had like massage parlor issues. Like, what the hell are we doing, brothers? This is a break in Ahava. Like, how is a woman meant to feel safe if our mind, our heart, our eyes, our bodies are going in other directions? And sisters, I know he's not perfect, but if you're imagining a man that's a better version of the one, you don't think we can feel that? God, we're already so insecure in this area, in this hyper-pornified environment. Like, it's the Ahava that holds us and makes this safe. The Ahava is the exaltation of safety for the man and the woman so that we won't be used and abused. It's the I'm not going anywhere. Okay. I want to end with a story. I don't think I've told this story in like 15 years, but it's hard for me to talk about these things because I know some of the struggle of shame that's attached to this. So let me end with this story. My freshman year of college, I sat next to a young woman. She was 26 and was a disaster. Here's what I mean by a disaster. She already had a three-year-old, and she was currently, at the time, having an extramarital affair with a married man. She wasn't married, but he was married. And so she's already got a kid. She had blown her life up, drugs, the whole thing. And now she's trying to put her life back together as a 26-year-old. So she enrolls in school, ends up sitting next to me, and I start this conversation with her, and then I just kind of move her into my crew. And so, man, we babysat for her, and we kind of created space for her, and she actually became one of our friends. And she would say years later, there was the first group of men she'd ever been around that never sexualized her. And so she became one of our crew, and we were sharing the gospel with her. All her interaction with church had been terrible. And so we were this kind of new, weird, fun thing. And so my friend Robbie C, I don't know if you know who Robbie C is, but just an anointed voice. Like, I think when he sings, like that thing that when David was singing to Saul and the demons got off of him, I think like that's what happens when Robbie sings. And so Robbie was playing at this youth rally not far out of town. And so I was like, we should go. And we invited this girl to go with us. Hey, you should come. You should come and check out my friend. Here's how I pitched it. Hey, man, a friend of mine's in a band. You want to come with us? And she was almost always game to hang if she wasn't. I mean, she worked multiple jobs. She could get off. So she got off work, and we went to see Robbie at this youth rally. I mean, like 1,000 kids in the room, so it was wheels off. And Robbie just crushed it, man. He just absolutely crushed it. And then the guy got up to preach, and I'm just letting you know, I am still very much in the box towards him. I don't like him. I don't know where he is. I think he did an astonishing amount of damage that day. And he starts to teach, and I'm like, oh crap, I brought her to a True Love Waits rally. I brought this 26-year-old with a kid, train wreck of a life, currently sleeping with a married man woman, to a True Love Waits rally. And so this guy, and I'm just, maybe it was my heart, it wasn't my heart, it was terrible. It's all prohibitive, all fear-based, all, and early in the sermon, he pulls out this rose and he like smells the rose and he kind of touches the petals and he just talks about how beautiful. In fact, it's so beautiful. Everybody should experience it. And so he like tosses it down. He's like, I want to just pass it around. I want everybody to. And then the whole sermon, it was just like, you know, venereal diseases. And it was just, it's like nonsense. I mean, maybe I'm just feeling it hyper because I know who I brought. I don't know if you've ever brought a friend with you and you just so desperately want them to meet Jesus and some idiot like me gets up and just kind of sabotages all that you've done before you brought them there. You're like, yeah, you're doing it right now. And so he goes and I'm so ready for him to be over. I can see her squirming. I'm feeling terrible that I brought her here. I mean, she already battled with such shame. She felt so dirty. Felt so, and then I'm like, I can't believe I did this to her. And then near the end of his little talk, he was like, hey, where's that rose? And some kid came from the back, the thing snapped in half. There's like one petal left on it. And that son of a dog held that thing up and said, now who would want this? And I just remember, one, wanting to physically assault him, and two, wanting to scream, Jesus wants the rose! Like, he wants it. It's what we believe. It's like the whole thing of our faith, and we read it already in the passage, is that you are not your own. You've been bought with a price, and Christ knew what he was buying on the cross, and there is nothing dirty or broken, past, present, or future, that he's not right here, right now, going, I want it. I'll buy it. I'll buy it with my blood. And so I don't know how all of this is landing on you today. I know, man, this is painful stuff. This is painful stuff, man. I know. I've been in this game counseling and walking with people for over 30 years. The amount of complexities that are in this, the amount of damage that can be done. And I'm just, if you don't hear anything else, please hear me say this to you. Jesus wants you. He wants you. You are not beyond his grasp. You are not so dirty as to not be made clean. In fact, the miracle of Jesus' ministry is that all the Jewish laws of uncleanliness was that if anything unclean touched what was clean, it dirtied up that clean thing, and then that clean thing would have to be purified. Jesus, though, when unclean things touch him, he cleanses them. Like the woman who bled, she touches Jesus' garment. Jesus didn't need to go become clean. She was made whole. This is the gospel. This is what Christians have believed in and moved towards, that we are wanted by him despite us. And there is no amount of dirtiness that can make him dirty. His cleanliness cleanses all of us of all unrighteousness. That he has made him who knew no sin, Jesus Christ, to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Do you see it? His righteousness given to us, our filthiness taken from us, so that we're seen as pure and spotless and clean in front of him. Listen, I hate that all I can do is appeal to you. I want you to have this so much. Gosh, I know what shame feels like in your heart. I know what it's like to look around and think you've just destroyed your whole life. I know what it's like to think, man, I've already gone this far, that, you know, there's no hope. No, there is hope. There is hope. You aren't good enough to outrun him. Maybe I'll say that you ain't bad enough to outrun him. You ain't gross enough to outrun him. You ain't defiled enough to outrun him. The offer on the table, if you're like broke and there's like one little petal left and it's lost its scent, is that he wants you. Look at me. If no one else in the world does, he does. I get, man, like rejection, trauma, brokenness carried with you into this thing. And maybe some of it over here too, but maybe a misunderstanding from over here, not knowing how to engage with it and not, God, I get that too, man. You know, nobody's trained us for this stuff. Life's hard and complex. And we can be idiots as men. And ain't like you ladies are, you know, bastions of wisdom either. I mean, this is a complex situation we find ourselves in. But the picture that is painted towards us and for us is one of intimacy and connection at a level we can't get our minds around. And so even sex, this kind of sex, it is a picture of God's desire for you to know him in the most intimate way imaginable. This is not about thou shalt nots and thou shalts. All of those are about something more beautiful than maybe the decision you're making right now. You are wanted by him. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pray for us. And then when I'm done praying, we're going to head straight into communion, not because I went long, but because I've done this long enough to know that if I just put all our prayer team up here and do an altar call, this is a tough sermon to come forward on. I just know, like, it's already hard, and then we'll just be like, oh, everybody's going to think I'm looking at porn, or they're going to think that I'm an abuser, they're going to think. And so here's my offer. When the service is dismissed, our prayer team will be up here. Will you let us help you? If this isn't, will you please come on Wednesday night? I know recovery sounds weird, but just come. Maybe it just needs to be you. I can tell you this about Lauren and I and our 7-year debacle. I got help in a different place than she got help. I worked on me in a different place. She worked on herself in a different place. And then God started to heal as we worked on one another. So maybe your marriage problem is a you problem right now. And let's go get help, whatever you can own. Would you come and let us help? It doesn't have to be this way. I promise you, it doesn't. But you can, here's what's maddening. You can choose just to stay stuck. You can just choose to stay there. I'm just pleading with you that you're wanted by someone who can make all the difference in the world. I'm not talking about therapy. I'm talking about transformation of soul. I'm talking about new life. I'm talking about a life mulligan to you today. It's there for the taking. But I can't make you take it. I can't jam it into your soul. You'll have to want to receive that someone wants you. Why don't you do me a favor? Why don't you bow your heads, close your eyes? Why don't you cup your hands in front of you for me? Will you do that? Just cup your hands. We're just getting our physical body involved here a little bit. Just cup your hands there. Holy Spirit, I don't know if there are things that need to be taken out of these hands right now. Hurts, brokennesses, betrayals. Will you pull those things out this morning? And Holy Spirit, I ask you in your mercy, will you lavish upon us an awareness of your nearness, of your goodness, of your grace? We need your grace. Like, we've just come in. We're just an imperfect gaggle of fools. Help us. I thank you that you don't ever get tired of lavishing upon us new mercy and grace. I think it doesn't bother you to do it. It doesn't diminish you to do it. You delight to lavish upon us your mercy and grace. I pray for my brother or sister that feels hopelessness right now, that just it's too good to be true, or that they're too far gone. I pray just an imprecatory psalm over the whisper in their mind. Would you break the jaw of the voice in their head that's telling them that this can't be true for them and they're too far gone or too damaged? I think there's no such thing as people that are too damaged. You delight to pull and rescue from the most damaged and most broken. This is one of your greatest joys. And so will you convince us today of your beauty and grace? It's for your beautiful name I pray. Amen.